Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Now we go to Poland on the eve of World War II and to a story of a Jewish family ripped away from each other at the start of the German and Russian occupation of Poland and their extraordinary journey back to each other. Our next guest, Georgia Hunter, did not know that her family was made up of Holocaust survivors, not until she was 14 years old. Once she found out, she went on a quest to uncover her family's story for herself and to eventually retrace their journey ultimately back together. And now she's written a book about it. It's called We Were the Lucky Ones. She joins us now. Georgia Hunter, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is an extraordinary story just to hear about how you did not know your family's history until you were about 14, and then you knew very little about it. Why was that?
I did. Yeah. You know, we talk about that a lot. And I think my grandfather, Addie, who you meet in chapter one, like many survivors, chose once he kind of made it, once he made it to the States, it was on safe territory, and he started a family, and he got his business up and running. He just put that piece of him behind him. He was a forward-thinking guy, and he, he had seen what being Polish and Jewish could have, should have done for his family, and decided not to dwell on it. Now, interestingly, some of his other siblings did retain their Jewish heritage and did talk a little bit more about it. And when my mother was growing up, he would travel back to Brazil, where he had brothers, and he'd celebrate Passovers with him, but he wouldn't tell the family that that's what he was doing. So he kept it up in sort of his own personal way, but it just wasn't a piece of our dialogue. And I was so young, I was an only child, and you know, he was pretty sick by the time I was about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. So it just wasn't part of our conversations, interestingly.
Yeah, very interesting. I have often mused about this theory that we carry victimization in our DNA. And I think that that's very interesting. Your grandfather's approach may have been sort of wrapped up somewhat in that, where he didn't want to continue living through his victimization.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about that?
I've thought about that a lot too. And, you know, I've read about that, and I think that could be a piece of it. I think, you know, his choice to kind of disassociate it probably was equal parts for himself as well as for future generations. And, you know, I don't know. I'd like to, I wonder all the time if I could have, you know, asked him about it. And I don't think it was some big secret. I don't think he would have said, oh no, I'm not talking about it. I think he would have opened up. I just think it wasn't, the weight of it wasn't something he wanted to carry with him. And, you know, when he did talk about the little pieces that he, you know, would tell my mom and my uncle, my aunt about, they were told almost anecdotally, you know, with laughter. And then, can you believe it? I ended up in the music salon of this ship full of refugees, and we'd gather around the piano every night. And this is when he's escaping France for Brazil. And a lot of the stories were actually passed down to me with that levity, and I wonder if that's how the, you know, my grandfather's generation told them, as a way of, you know, not harboring not holding on to the horrificness of it,
right,
but rather trying to remember the pieces of it that got them through, like the fact that my grandfather was still making music throughout the war, like the fact that there were romances, there were babies being born. And that was one of the things that amazed me in my research, is I thought it would just be one horrific event after another, which it was, but it was interspersed with these moments of levity and of love and of this family bond. I just felt it so much when I...
Oops. Well, she was right in the middle of a great thought. Hopefully she'll give us a call right back. And here she is. Georgia, we have you back.
I'm back. Sorry, I have no idea what happened.
I don't know either. But, well, we were just talking a little bit amongst ourselves, waiting for you to get back on. To talk about, maybe before we go any further, to talk about how you created a novel out of this story. And it's very, you know, it follows the history of your family, but there were certain things that you wanted to do that were, that involved fiction. And so could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I know. I thought actually long and hard about writing it as nonfiction because I'd spent so long researching it. I think it was 9 years from start to finish.
Oh,
and
wow.
And every narrative, all the storylines of who was where and when is absolutely based on the truth and uncovered in my research. But what I found in the end and in my early draft, it was, everything kind of came together in the shape of a timeline first. And then I realized, okay, well, I could leave it at that, but I really want to put it into a format that's readable, something people can relate to. So I want to turn it into a book, and how do I do that? And that was when I made the decision that even though I had the bones of the story, I felt like I was missing the connective tissue. So like the emotional piece of it, what were they thinking? What were they feeling? So unfortunately, I wasn't able to interview my grandfather and his siblings firsthand. So that's when I kind of decided to allow myself the creative license to fictionalize and to imagine those details and try to make the story feel very human, very less black and white, more colorful, like see it as they were seeing it, put readers in their shoes. And I don't know, I hope that in the end, by allowing myself to fictionalize it, it might have even brought the story closer to the truth.
So, Georgia, about the title, We Were the Lucky Ones. We were the lucky ones. Does that reference those who were not the lucky ones, who were left behind? Because it looks like, you know, your story, as you said, Addie's telling it with some humor and anecdotally. And it's not something that seems to be infused with a great amount of trauma. And as you said, that there's probably a reason for that. He's trying to leave that behind and move forward and not put it into the DNA of the family, as Lynn mentioned. But at the same time, there were those who were not the lucky ones. And is the title part of a reference towards those and honoring those who didn't make it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought a lot about how to write this book in a way that would pay respect to the majority. And, you know, my family was somewhat of a statistical anomaly, and that's not something that you necessarily want to shout from the rooftop. So I was very conscious of that in my writing and in the way I talk about it. And I included scenes from the ghetto that were, you know, that I hadn't been told firsthand, but that I read about in other firsthand accounts, because I really wanted to make sure readers understood that, yes, while my family was able to skirt the concentration camps, this was what was going on around them. And it was horrific. And yes, they were able to hold on to some of their semblances of their old lives here and there. But it was definitely the darkest chapter of their lives. So for sure, the title pays respect to those who were not so lucky. And it's also, interestingly, was actually verbatim, came from my great aunt Felicia, who I think I mentioned was a year old at the start of the war. And so she was there at that family reunion in the year 2000. And when we were sitting around and everyone was telling stories, and at the end of the night, she spoke up and said, you know, looked around and said, you know, we really shouldn't be here. It's almost a miracle that we're all here today. We were the lucky ones. And so obviously that sentiment stuck with me.
That's a beautiful place to get the title from. And that fact that you were sitting around hearing these stories and the title of what would become your book came out of that session of hearing these oral stories. I'm curious about the research that you did and how important is the oral aspect, and or was there enough written documentation for you to go back and reconstruct the events in the way that you needed to do so?
It was a combination of both. I'd say probably more oral history than outside research. Everybody had this kind of vague storyline of how their father or mother or parents managed to survive. So what I would do is I would take what I found in my interviews, that oral history, and then I'd try to back it up with the outside research. So if I knew, for example, that the one brother was sent to Siberia, I'd track down records from that time and place. And that actually, amazingly, I was even able to find a handwritten account of my great uncle Genix, who spent a year in the Gulag with his wife and his son who was born there, about, you know, exactly why he was arrested in Poland, why and when he was sent off to Siberia, how long it took to get there, the name of the camp, what they were doing there, why they were released. And then I had a couple relatives that joined the Polish army, which fell under the wing of the British army, and they kept immaculate records. So I had that. So I basically kind of took the bones of the story and then tried to back it up with the outside research, add, pepper in those details that I was able to find through digitalized records and through these, queries that I would write. And sometimes it would take, I'd hire a translator, I'd write some memorial center in Moscow, and then sometimes it would be like 11 months later, I'd get a letter in the mail. And there might be one name and one date, but I'd pop that into my timeline and get really excited about it, and then on to the next one. It was really a combination of oral and outside research.
And I'm wondering, where did this, I know where this book came from. It came from your history and your family's history, but are you a novelist, a writer? What kind of inspired you to take this on as a project and create this narrative that is now out in paperback?
You know, this came from such a personal place. I guess going into it, I call myself a family historian, or I was attempting to be. I kind of had my detective hat on and was just asking a lot of questions and doing a lot of digging. I never imagined, to be honest, that it would turn into what it has today and find itself in the hands of so many readers. But because I really set off to write it or to research this piece of my history for the family, for the people who lived through it, and then for my kids and their kids and so on. So that's where it all began. I have a career as a copywriter, so I write, in marketing materials, that kind of thing, for travel companies, which has helped me in my writing of, like, how I set a scene, maybe, and how I describe settings. But this is definitely a first-time project for me, this first novel of mine.
It's kind of interesting to tie it to our previous interview. In the first half of the hour was with Tama Keeves, and her book is called Thriving Through Uncertainty, and it's about, you know, like following your passion and reaching out to, whether it is in this hobby that you somehow were driven and compelled to uncover over 9 years. You followed that. And her argument is that uncertainty, going towards what you're passionate about, is actually quite secure. And when you're there, you know it. You know that this is the step that you need to take. And you must have felt that way. I mean, researching this for 9 years, you're not just a family historian. There was something in this that propelled you forward.
Oh, I know. I guess it was just, it was very innate. You know, it was like, I knew I had to do it, and it was only a matter of time. And I guess that is a bit unique. If it was somebody else's story, I don't know if I would have felt as driven, but I feel like there was never am I going to finish this, or am I going to finally put the last piece of the puzzle together? It's, when am I going to do it? It's just something I knew I had to do. But I like that the idea that even if there's an uncertainty to it, I wasn't sure how it would all come together, but I knew it would somehow, some way, because I was so passionate about it. Like, it was just piece of me, you know, it was just something I had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the book is We Were the Lucky Ones. Our guest is Georgia Hunter. And Georgia, you know, I have the timeline sitting in front of me, but you must have a pretty good, like, minute or two explanation of sort of where your family went and how they got spread out all over the globe. You talked a little bit about Siberia, and we've talked about Brazil, but can you go from the source, where you lived and then what happened?
From where they were raised in Poland.
Yes.
I mean? Mm-hmm. Or my personal travels and my research.
Oh, sorry. No, your family's living in Poland. It's 1939, and where did they go from there?
So, yeah, so my grandfather was living in Toulouse in France, and he was where he was. He would frequent the jazz clubs in Paris, and the story has it, he got a letter one day from his mother saying, I don't think it's safe for you to return home for Passover this year. And sure enough, he found himself stuck and had a short stint in the Polish column of the French army, and then apparently forged his own demobilization papers when he realized he needed to get out, and found a visa, which was actually issued illegally, I learned, through an ambassador named Sousa Dantas, and he got on a boat that was meant to take him to Brazil, but that ended up getting delayed in both Dakar and in Casablanca. So he found himself in Casablanca with an expired visa, but I won't give too much away. He eventually makes his way to South America. And then the rest of the family in Poland, so when I first set off in my research, I figured, okay, well, I'll have my grandfather's piece and then I'll have the family in Poland. But I quickly realized that each of their stories were going to be different. They all had their individual path to survival. So, yeah, so one brother ended up in Siberia for a year before being granted amnesty on the condition that he fight for Stalin. When Stalin decided he was going to be, you know, Hitler turned his back on Stalin. Stalin's now part of the Allies. So, okay, all those Polish prisoners in my gulag, you are released, but you will fight for me. So, again, my great-uncle really had no other choice but to join the army, and it took almost a year for him to reach Persia, cross the Caspian Sea, join the army, and then he fought in the Italian campaign. Actually, he was in northern Africa and then fought in the Italian campaign, and probably the most famous battle is the Battle of Monte Cassino. That was his piece. Another brother ended up in Lvov. The mother-daughter sister, my grandfather's sister Mila and her daughter were in the ghetto in Rodom, and they actually had to figure out how to escape the ghetto, again, without giving too much away. But once they finally managed to get out, they lived with false IDs in Warsaw. Their paths took them all over Poland, and then finally through what was then Czechoslovakia, Austria, and down the coast of Italy along the Adriatic coast. So when I went down, when I went to Europe to do my traveling in their footsteps, that's the path that I took. I kind of followed in their footsteps throughout Eastern Europe, which was also quite moving.
Georgia, I'm wondering what your intention was for your readers, because I know that from your standpoint, just revealing this amazing family history that's a compelling novel and a compelling story, was that enough for your readers, for you to provide that to them, or did you have a different intention and hope for when they finished your book they'd walk away with something else?
Certainly the story that I felt like needed to be told for the story's sake, because it really, what they endured and how they managed to survive feels almost unbelievable at times. But I think more so I really wanted to tell their story, which takes place in this chapter of history, which will soon feel ancient, sadly, and which, you know, in many people's minds is with our perspective we have now, almost unfathomable, right, with the statistics that we know. I wanted to tell it in a very human way. So I hope that maybe readers might take away a personal story. So they may learn about what was going on from a global perspective and ask about where the family was. You know, they were really traveling across continents, trying to stay one step ahead and survive. So they kind of get this global perspective and historical perspective about what was going on at the time, but told through one family's lens. So in a very human way, that my hope will make the story feel, you know, that time in history feel more relevant and feel more personal.
And the feedback that you get from your readers, because now with a book that's very successful, it's been on the market for a while, you just came out with the paperback. Is there anything surprising that you hear from readers?
Oh, I'm just, it's very surreal to know that my very personal family history is in the hands of so many readers. I still have to pinch myself And I knew my family would buy a copy. I didn't realize so many people around the world now. It's been published in all different languages, and so many people. And I'm blown away by the response it's gotten, how it's resonating, and people seem to people seem to be moved by different aspects of it. So I might get a note to my Facebook page or to my email through my website about, oh my gosh, I had family. My family was from Rodham, and do you know how I can research their history? Do you have any advice? Or my family had the last name Kirk too. Or even just my grandfather was a survivor and never talked about it. Or I have grandparents who are survivors, and now I'm going to ask them about it. You know, so everybody's kind of taking something different away, which I think is so neat, and it makes me so happy to know that it's resonating and that people are inspired to ask questions, maybe research their own ancestry, or maybe even just think about that time in history and what it might mean to them personally.
Right. I would imagine, and it seems to me that the further that we get away from this horrible chapter in our history, that the stories come more infrequently and fewer and further between. And so when I saw your book, that was the first thought that occurred to me. Wow, I haven't really read any current literature or seen a current, film on the Holocaust. And that was the first thing that came across for me. Have you gotten those kinds of comments as well?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's scary because there are hardly any survivors left to tell their stories firsthand. But I do, and while I think, mine is its own thing, I do think there are, it's interestingly, more and more third generation survivors trying to go down the same path that I have been down, where there is, I don't know if it's just enough distance or the sense of urgency to tell the stories, but I do feel like there are so many authors out there right now that have this sort of skipped a generation and who are now asking the questions and writing down their family's stories or even just aspects of their family's stories. And I hope that continues. I hope that it doesn't kind of fizzle out. I hope it becomes more important now than ever to keep these stories alive.
That's right. Well, the book is We Were the Lucky Ones. Our guest is Georgia Hunter, and I just have to congratulate you on this tremendous amount of work that you did to put this book together. It's really fantastic. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
And again, Georgia Hunter. So it's out in paperback, but it was published in 2017. So I'm not sure which month, but it's already a national bestseller. So the really fantastic story, and the story of the story is as interesting, really. Let's thank our underwriters quickly.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, Davidson Orthopedics, Jim Duenley and Mark Wainsgard with retail at New Park, Fairway Independent Mortgage, and Valley Behavioral Health.
And thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Time now for NPR News.